Hi, this is John Jenkins, senior editor of deallawyers.com, and I'd like to welcome you to this edition of our Deal Lawyers Download podcast. My guests today are Kip Wallen and Chris Letang from SRS Aquium. Kip and Chris were involved in preparing the latest edition of SRS Aquium's annual M&A deal term study, which I blogged about last month on the Deal Lawyers blog. The study is one that practitioners look forward to seeing every year because of the breadth and depth of the data that it provides. And given what the folks at SRS Aquium do for a living, they've got access to a lot of deal data and a lot of data about a lot of deals, and that's what makes the study an essential resource. Kip and Chris have graciously agreed to discuss some of the study's methodology and findings with us today. So welcome, gentlemen, and thanks for agreeing to participate in today's podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, John.
So why don't we kick it off by if you could both just tell us a little bit about yourselves and your background.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. And again, it's just great to be here. My name is Chris Letang. I'm the managing director of escrow and payment solutions here at SRS Aquium, which, as the name implies, means that I work on our escrow and payments business. Prior to that, I managed our shareholder representation business. And I also spent quite a bit of time working with Kip on our data studies and other thought leadership work. I am also a corporate lawyer by training, having practiced at Cravath and Cooley prior to joining SRS Aquium.
Yeah, again, it's just it's such a pleasure to be here, and I get made fun of at SRS Aquium because I get so excited talking about the data, so I'll try to contain it for your listeners today. But I have a background in M&A as well. I practiced for 10 years. I cut my teeth at a boutique firm here in Denver, Colorado, doing mostly sell-side M&A. And then about 4 years ago, I joined SRS Aquium with their deal intake group. So whenever SRS was being engaged as a professional shareholder rep or a paying agent or an escrow agent, I'd be the one negotiating those engagements and actually getting into the merger agreements and other ancillary agreements. And so just lots of great experience and exposure to hundreds of deals during that time. And then about 6 months ago, I took this new position where I lead up our thought leadership practice. So now I get to focus all my time and energy on our deal term studies and all this other great content that we put out with the aim of, you know, having really helpful and useful resources for M&A practitioners out there.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk a little bit about the study. Can you tell us a little bit about the scope and the methodology of the M&A deal terms study and some of the notable trends that you identified in 2021 deals?
Yeah, absolutely, John. So our methodology is we have access to a lot of great U.S. private M&A deals. And so when we're engaged on those deals as the shareholder rep, we're often provided just about the entire closing binder. And from that, we're able to go in and pull all these interesting data points and aggregate that to put these studies together. So we have a dedicated, really well-trained, experienced docket team that goes through these agreements, pulls all those data points out. And then when we put the data together, we try and do it in the most useful and practical way. So providing several years of data so readers can identify different trends and how things are changing year over year. And because we work on so many deals at SRS Aquium and we're including several years of data, our latest study had almost 2,000 deals represented in the data set. And for deals that closed in 2021 alone, it's over 500 deals. So those of us who were working in M&A last year know it was just a record-breaking year. We were all very, very busy, but that worked out great for our data study because it's a really nice, robust data set that we're able to pull some interesting means and medians and data trends as well. About a third of our deals are tech target deals, so really nice representation of tech M&A. We also have a really notable presence of private equity buyers, either directly or through their portcos, so PE-backed buyers. And then about 44% of our deals included reps and warranties insurance, so where the parties were using a buy-side reps and warranty policy.
Yeah, and at this point, you know, we've been putting out the deal term study regularly for nearly a decade now, and it really has become quite influential and sought after among deal parties and their attorneys and their advisors. So, you know, we're just really happy to be able to provide this resource to deal practitioners. And I guess just I would also note that you know, most of the M&A deals included in the study are not publicly reported, which makes it a little bit different than some of the other studies that are out there and gives a little different flavor in terms of the data set that we have. So a few of the trends that I would note, you know, the first is really just the overall volume, as Kip sort of alluded to. You know, 2021 was just a huge year for M&A, and we saw that reflected in higher deal counts as well as high valuations. So, I mean, that's a story at the market level. when it comes to specific deal terms, we saw some interesting trends too. We saw more deals where buyer equity was part of the deal consideration. That was especially common in technology deals, where perhaps the booming stock prices of some of the strategic acquirers out there played a role in making that an attractive option. We saw earnouts, which had become more popular during the early stages of the pandemic, like in 2020, just as a way to get deals done during those uncertain times, come back down again, at least somewhat, in terms of their prevalence and overall size. And we also just continue to see some trends from prior years persist, such as more deals continuing to use RWI and more deals without general survival for the indemnification provisions, both of which are more seller-friendly terms. So I just think it'll be interesting to see, which of those trends stick around in 2022, given the tumult that we've seen in the markets and otherwise this year so far.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of those points. I have always had a real fascination with earnouts. When I was doing M&A, I hated dealing with them, but I've always found them a fascinating concept. And, the whole idea of using them to bridge the gap. I mean, it tends to work a lot better in theory than it does in practice, but they're very interesting. And you'd mentioned that you saw a fall off in earnouts last year. And I wonder if you can speculate. I mean, it wasn't just the fall off, but the amount of consideration that was tied to them and also the duration of the earnout periods. Any thoughts on whether this is just a reflection of the very strong seller's market that we saw in 2021, or if there are other factors that were driving kind of the changes in the approach to earnouts?
Yeah, John, I can jump in on that. Yeah, earnouts, I agree with your sentiment. They're not on a majority of deals. It was about 1 in 5 deals use an earnout. And so interestingly, we didn't see as much of a drop off in the frequency of using earnouts from 2020 to 2021. But we did see some seller kind of favorable movement on the specifics of those earnouts. So like you were alluding to, the length and the amount tied up in the earnout. And so I think a strong seller's market definitely drove some of those more seller favorable movements. But the seller favorable market last year was driven by a lot of different things. There were high valuations, financial buyers with lots of capital to deploy, strategic and public buyers were getting more active last year with their M&A strategy. And that resulted in increased competition among buyers. Parties were pretty eager, I think, to make moves after taking a more kind of wait and see approach in 2020. So there's a lot of seller favorable things going on, but also we did see some sort of hints that there was still uncertainty in the market last year, right? That we had supply chain issues, there were labor shortages, COVID relief packages were expiring. And so all those together, I think, kind of mixed together to have a relatively flat line in the use of earnouts, still about 1 in 5 deals. It was 18% of deals in 2021. But the specifics, of how long those earnouts lasted and how much money was tied up, those tended to trend a little bit more seller favorable.
Yeah, I guess I would say earnouts are going to be something that are still top of mind for deal makers, just given the environment. And from what we've been seeing, they're going to continue to be just an active area of negotiation, both before and after the deals close. As we saw in the early stages of the pandemic, the deal parties were looking to earnouts to bridge those valuation gaps, as you alluded to, John. But that did start to wane a bit in 2021. Maybe as it seemed like things were returning at least somewhat to normal on a deal making front. But now again in 2022, we start to see some of those difficulties again. So it'll be interesting to see what the data shows for 2022. I would also note that this isn't necessarily just a question of how these earnouts are structured up front. As shareholder representative, we've seen a lot of deals with earnouts that have been renegotiated after deals close, since perhaps things haven't exactly gone according to plan, either to some of the supply chain issues or COVID issues or all the different types of things that are out there. So, and I think in a lot of cases, it's sort of driven by talent retention objectives of the buyer, really just wanting to keep their stakeholders in the deal happy, even if things haven't gone exactly according to plan. So, these earnouts can be a tool to work through, work through some of those issues if they're done well and can at least in theory solve some problems. But as you know, it doesn't necessarily always work out that way either. Yep.
Devil's definitely in the details on that. Now, another thing that, Chris, you had touched on in your overview of trends was the growth of the non-survival of reps and warranties provisions. That's typically been associated with public company deals. It's been around in some competitive situations with private deals in the past. But the study suggests that no-survival deals are becoming increasingly common, both in deals with rep and warranty insurance and in non-RWI deals. So can you folks elaborate on that trend?
Yeah, I'll jump in. So the data is very interesting there. Over the last couple of years, we've seen the rise of no survival deals. And so, and we should clarify, for a no survival deal, we're talking about are the sellers directly on the hook. So you can have a walk away or a no survival deal that also has RWI. And you know, and as you mentioned, I think RWI definitely comes into play here and is one of the drivers of why a buyer might be more comfortable with a walk away style deal if they have that RWI to fall back on. But I don't think that's the only factor here, because if you look at non-RWI deals, there also was a pretty big increase from 2020 to 2021. 2020 deals saw about 12% of non-RWI deals structured as a walkaway. That increased up to 18% for 2021 deals. So RWI is one factor that's driving the higher prevalence of these walkaway deals, but it's not the only thing. And I have some thoughts on why that might be, but I'm curious what Chris thinks about that.
I would say, you know, if we look back last year, just given the competition among buyers for acquisitions, buyers were just looking for ways to make their offers more attractive, and you know, a walkaway structure could certainly do that. But even taking that into account, I mean, buyers could still build in some level of protection. For example, what our data tracks deals that have no general survival period, but some of those deals, you know, may still have an indemnification for, say, known litigation matters or diligence items that popped up, or, you know, for other things which the sellers are still expressly on the hook for under the terms of the agreement. And in those cases, there's usually a special escrow established in lieu of just sort of that larger general indemnity escrow that you see in some other deals. And the same is also true for the purchase price adjustment provision, where we're continuing to see more deals with a separate purchase price adjustment escrow fund. So, it's just type of thing where it was certainly used as a tool, I think, by buyers to make their deals more attractive. But in some respects, they are also able to, maintain some level of protection from an indemnity perspective, in addition to RWI policies out there.
Kip, don't leave us hanging. You said you had some thoughts on where that may be as well.
Yeah, well, I think Chris is hitting the nail right on the head there, that it's competition among buyers. You know, anything they can do to make their bid a little bit more attractive. And sellers just had a lot of leverage last year, right? It wasn't a perfect environment for sellers. There was still some uncertainties, with supply chain issues and things like that we've mentioned earlier. But yeah, I think buyers were just really motivated to make these acquisitions and therefore it just made them more willing to agree to seller favorable terms like a walkaway structure.
One of the other things I found interesting in the data was you had a lot of data in there about management carve-outs, which have always been a very interesting phenomenon. And maybe can you discuss what you found about management carve-outs in deals?
Yeah, absolutely, John. So I think the big takeaway there is that this has been a pretty long-term trend. And we did in this year's study, we went back and looked from 2010 on, it's been a pretty steady decline. And I think that sort of correlates with the sort of high valuations that we've seen for the last decade or so. Of course, all bets are off in 2022. This will be one particular data point to keep an eye on, because I think some of these trends will reverse in the current year. But so we saw, you know, management carve-outs kind of hit a low watermark in 2021. Only 4.5% of the deals in our data set included one. It's slightly higher if you look at just those tech deals, 5.4%. And a little lower if you look at deals where it was a private equity buyer, only 2% of those deals had a management carve-out. There are some other factors here too that can influence. So the size of the deal definitely matters. Smaller deals are more likely to have a management carve-out. That's somewhat intuitive. So about 13.5% of deals that were $50 million or less in transaction value included a carve-out, compared to only 2% of deals that were valued at $100 million or more. So deal size is a factor. Also, the return on equity. So if we go and look at how much capital had been invested into that target and compare that to the M&A exit transaction value and get that return, you know, the lower that return is, the more likely there's going to be a management carve out. And that's pretty obvious. So if you look at the deals in our data set with a 3x or less return, about half of those had a management carve out. But last year was such a great year for sellers. Valuations were high. The average return was 5.3x. So most of our deals were above that 3x return. And that's why, you know, that overall it was only 4.5% that included a management carve out. And I think, you know, there's a lot of things that I think are going to kind of continue to drive this trend, but kind of what we saw, I don't know, Chris, if you can elaborate on this better than I can, but I think, you know, some of the factors driving a low use of management carve outs in the last couple of years, you know, might be reversing, like valuations and things like that. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, this has been an interesting one. I mean, we've watched, you know, over the years, just seeing fewer and fewer deals have management carve outs. And there's been a couple of times where through the years we've looked at it and said, oh, you know, this will be the year when the trend reverses. And it just hasn't quite happened yet. I think to some extent that's because, you know, valuations have just kept increasing, thus making it just less common to have large portions of your management equity that's not in the money. And, you know, but again, at the outset of the pandemic, we definitely anticipated that there'd be larger disruptions to valuations than what actually happened. And so, you know, as a result, then instead of there being a resurgence in carve-outs of 2020, the decline continued. But here we are again. You know, this is another year where valuations are experiencing disruption, you know, with the volatility in the stock market and other factors. So, you know, it's possible that maybe this is the year where we start to see more deals of the management carve-out. But can't say that based on the data just yet. But we'll have to see.
Great. Well. In case you're wondering, you can access the SRS Aquium deal study on SRS's website. And if you go to my blog on May 16th, there's a link to the download page. It's still free, gentlemen, isn't it? I mean, I know it was free a month ago. So, yes, it is. They're nodding. That's you can't right. see them nodding their heads, but yes, they are. It's still free. And believe me, we've just scratched the surface of what's in there. If you're not familiar with it, I highly encourage you to poke around. As you probably picked up from our discussion here, that there's just a tremendous amount of really good information in there that will help you in your practice. So. And I definitely would like to thank Kip and Chris for spending some time with us today. I thought this was a really interesting conversation, and thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Thank you. Appreciate it.